and welcome to The Doctor Will Hear You Now, the podcast hosted by me, Dr. Zoe Williams. Now, I'm a practicing GP and medical professional, but in this podcast series, I'm not the expert. In The Doctor Will Hear You Now, I'm here to learn from you. Each episode, I'll face a health condition which is riddled with stigma and misinformation. By passing the microphone, literally, to a well-known name, join me as I learn their story. Plus, with the help of our wonderful series sponsor, Bupa, we'll be joined a bit later on in each episode by someone who has a lot of experience in the subject matter. Together, we'll leave each episode with a greater understanding. This is The Doctor Will Hear You Now. So we've reached the final episode of this series and we're topping it off with a really interesting topic, and we've had lots of requests to include this topic on the podcast, which is quite interesting, especially because 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, this particular topic is not something that we'd have been talking about in magazines, on social media, down the pub, but now, and rightly so, more and more people are interested in and talking about their gut health. And here to join me to discuss this topic, we're very lucky to have this guest today, is Catherine Tilsley, who you'll all know being an actress, but she's also a model and a comedian. You'll know her from the staples of British TV, Coronation Street, Scarborough, Lilies, and of course, not forgetting when she won our hearts over on Strictly Come Dancing. But what we probably didn't know as an audience was that at the time she was really struggling with symptoms related to her gut and her gut health. Thank you so much for joining me, Catherine.
Oh no, thank you for having me. Good to be here.
Auntie Kath, as you are on Instagram. First of all, the question I'd like to ask is, what is the one thing you should never say to somebody who is struggling with symptoms related to their gut health?
I think probably along the lines of, oh, you'd be fine, have a peppermint tea. You get that a lot if you've got tummy ache or if there's any kind of disruption with your gut health, a lot of people will say, just have a peppermint tea. Necessarily helpful.
Why would you say that is not helpful?
Do you know what? For some people, depending on the symptoms they're experiencing, I suspect it could be helpful.
Yeah.
But for me, when I first started to have issues with my gut, peppermint tea wouldn't cut it. I mean, I ended up in A&E twice and on a morphine drip. And now that I've had children, I can compare that pain to labour pains. It was that brutal. I thought I was dying. You know, it was awful. And it's been a journey for me on educating myself more about gut health. Because like you've just said, you know, 10 years ago or so, it's not something that we necessarily spoke about as often as we do now. And, you know, to know now that the gut is, you know, they call it the second brain, it is connected to every single function within your body. It's like, wow, how have we not been talking about this? Yeah. And you know, and started to learn more about it.
And you're right, and it's not just, you know, general public, as doctors, as scientists, it's quite new to us as well. And I think it's very exciting because the research in the past few years, which is helping us understand the gut and how it functions, the gut being a tube that starts at our mouth and goes all the way through our body to our anus, it's really, really fascinating. And we'll talk probably, I'm sure, about the microbiome a little bit. Mm-hmm. And we didn't even know about the microbiome really just a few years ago. So when would you say that you first became aware of the term gut health?
I think for me, you know, several years ago, I would experience a lot of pain, a lot of extreme bloating. Again, I would look pregnant and I just couldn't figure out what it was. And I started to keep a food diary. It turned out that I was severely intolerant to dairy. So I got rid of dairy. That helped quite a lot. But I also became aware that hormones would affect it. And I think that's a big thing for women, because I started to learn as well at certain times of the month, you know, when the uterus contracts, it's right next to the bowel. So that can set things off, can make you feel really uncomfortable. And so I started to look at things that would also stress me out and raise cortisol levels, because stress was a big part of things for me. And I started to delve into things like meditation. And I like to be as natural as I can. And at one point, I was on quite a lot of medication simply because of the pain. Looking back, my diet was not great. There was a lot of, you know, things like artificial sweeteners. And I know that's kind of all over the press at the moment. But I remember I was constantly trying to lose weight, but not necessarily doing it in the right way.
Right.
So there was a lot of fatty diet foods that were full of chemicals and sweeteners. And so it was just taking it back to nature for me.
Right.
And making life simpler in a way. If it ran, swam, or grew from the earth, eat it. Anything else had been tampered with and my body didn't really like it. So
this is what I think we're learning more and more about ultra processed foods, aren't we? Which actually, you know, sadly make up the majority of most people's diets nowadays. Yeah. And even 50 years ago, you know, we didn't have that. And 50 years ago, we didn't have, I mean, irritable bowel syndrome, I think, has always been around, but it's so common. I think it's one in five people now
have
IBS. So you've talked a little bit there about, you know, the severity of your symptoms landed you in A&E. You've made changes to your diet. You started using some probiotics. But let's go right back to the beginning of when you first started having symptoms, gut health symptoms. What symptoms were you having? What were you doing for work at the time? When did you first know that, I guess, your gut was giving you issues that other people didn't have?
It was probably when I was at drama school, which, looking back, again, my diet was terrible. I was a student. I was probably drinking a bit more than I should as
just,
well.
Maybe just a little bit. Not many students do that. Of course, I didn't do that.
No. A lot of processed food.
Yeah.
I just didn't really have the right education in terms of nutrition. And at school, you know, we made things like cake and pizza and lasagna and all the fun stuff, but we didn't really look at nutrition in the way that it should be taught. And I still don't believe in schools that we're quite there even now, all these years later.
I mean, I don't think they even get taught how to make pizzas and lasagnas anymore in school, to be honest. I think there's nothing,
it's really worrying, isn't it? Mm. And I know that, you know, child obesity is through the roof, cancer's through the roof. And I just think if we strip it back and look at what we're putting into our bodies, it's pretty terrifying. I look at somebody like my great-grandma, God bless her. She was 101 when she died. She lived frugally, ate from the land. They had their own allotment growing up. And you think, gosh, there's a lot to be said for that. Just taking things back to the way things were, because I do think all these processed foods, our gut does not like it. You know, things like artificial sweeteners for me really affected my gut. I was having a lot of those at drama school. And I think if your body doesn't recognize it, if it's not a natural substance, things kick off. And obviously there was a lot of adrenaline at drama school because we were constantly performing. So for me, the biggest issue was pain.
Right.
And it was like a labor pain. So I was taking a lot of painkillers. It was just a vicious circle. You know, if adrenaline...
What sort of painkillers were you taking? Were you having them prescribed as well as over-the-counter stuff?
Well, Nurofen was the most effective for me. But then I ended up with really bad acid and ulcers. So I should have been taking omeprazole or something but then I hate taking, medicine can be a wonderful thing, but looking back, if I just looked at my diet, I could have avoided all of that and just done things naturally. And I probably had a good, maybe 2 or 3 years of just a vicious cycle of the wrong foods, not managing my stress and medication, not necessarily the right medication.
Because I'm going to ask you a bit later on, kind of what is a typical diet, or, you know, what you might eat and drink in a day now. So back then at drama school, probably a couple of Smirnoff ices in the evening. But what would you have for breakfast or...
Back then?
Yeah.
Oh, do you know what? A lot of the time I'd skip breakfast and just grab like diet bars that were just full of unrecognizable foods that you couldn't...
70 different ingredients on the label.
So I've always struggled with my weight as well. And I just thought that was the easiest option.
You're always constantly trying to think about calories and that type of thing as well.
It was all the artificial stuff. And then same throughout the day, it would be, you know, maybe highly processed bread. a chicken salad sandwich, and it was just very little nutrients.
Like meal deal type food.
Yeah. And when you're a student,
yeah,
you know, you are on a budget. And again, now I know what I know. I could have been really budget savvy and still eaten really well.
But we didn't know, did we? You know, it was then you had what money you had. You ate so you didn't feel hungry to fill a hole, like you say. Also, you were very, growing up in an era where we were very conscious about body size and body shape. And wanted to go out and party and have fun. So it's
and Haribo, we were all addicted to Haribo. If we needed energy, we'd be like, get out the Haribo.
So that was drama school then.
Yeah.
And then how did things progress from there?
So towards the end of drama school, I was pretty poorly looking back. My mental health as well was not great. My anxiety. I was never diagnosed with depression, but I probably was a bit down. My skin was shocking. Like, I look back at old photographs now, and I just breakout after breakout, almost, I kind of look blue. It's just, I was the most bizarre colour. My body just wasn't getting any nutrients. Yeah. Uh-huh. So my parents were quite worried about me. I dropped a lot of weight as well. I probably wasn't consuming enough calories. And they booked me a session with a nutritionist. And it was from that moment when I sat down with this nutritionist, I was like, oh my God, what have I been doing to myself? This is completely my own fault, which is why, again, I'm so passionate about children being educated correctly now. Yeah. We'd save the NHS a small fortune, wouldn't we? So yeah, that was the real turning point. And then I've just carried on educating myself over the years. And I did a nutrition course with Dale Pinnock, the medicinal chef, who really helped me a lot on my journey. I felt like I learned so much from him and started to look at my hormones and how your gut would impact your hormones and what you were putting into your body. And so it's just been a real journey, and I'm still learning. But things are so much better now. I feel like a different person.
So what's a typical day in the life of Kath Tildesley now in terms of what you'd eat and drink? Probably no more Smirnoff Ice.
No more Smirnoff Ice, no. Oh, I'm much classier now. Sometimes.
A nice glass of Rioja.
So in the morning, you know, a firm favourite would be something like smoked salmon with eggs and avocado, some spinach. Or if I'm in a rush, I love to make fresh greens drinks. I might add some spirulina and some fresh ginger, things like that. Lunchtime would probably be something like fish and vegetables. And then in the evening, I don't know, maybe roast chicken with a jacket potato and some more veg. I prioritise veg.
Yeah.
As long as my plate looks colourful,
yeah,
I feel like I'm getting a really good range of nutrients, and I tend to snack on nuts, seeds, more vegetables.
Yeah.
And I just feel so much better for it.
Do you drink a lot of water as well?
Yes, at least 8 pints a day, which means, you know, I'm constantly...
8 pints a day?
Yes.
Wow.
The first thing I do when I wake up in the morning, I neck a pint of water just to make sure I'm hydrated. Yeah.
Gosh. So that, I mean, that sounds like you're hitting all the right things there, aren't you? You've got lots of fibre in there. You've got lots of different fruit and veg. You've got lots of diversity. You've got some like healthy protein sources. You've got your omegas because you're eating fish. You know, how has that path gone from where you were eating what sounded like a very highly processed diet, you saw the nutritionist? Has it sort of taken a long time to find that diet that works for you? And have there been any bumps in the road where actually, you know, things have... you've got out of that routine and you've gone back to old ways and you've suffered because of it?
Yeah. Do you know what? And it's going to make me sound incredibly dull, but the main reason that I don't eat junk food is because, let's say, you know, I go to a party, I'm a bit hungover the next day, which is rare because I don't drink that much. If I then decide I want to eat fast food, I feel really poorly after it.
Do you?
And I'm like, it's never worth it.
Yeah.
And I've learned how to make fakeaways at home using much better ingredients that taste just as good. They might not be as convenient, but the older I've got, the more I've gone, that's just so not worth it for me.
Yeah, you know, the price that you'll pay the next day sort of thing. Or, well, maybe even not the next day, straight away afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. Same with dairy. And when I found out how intolerant I was to dairy, that was a big eye-opener because I loved dairy. I mean, I was absolutely heartbroken when they told me I was intolerant because I was just obsessed. But there's lots of dairy alternatives now, you know, compared to 10
years
ago.
You get used to them, don't you? Because I did the dairy-free thing for a short while when I had my son, because there was a period where we thought he might have a cow's milk protein allergy. So, but it's in everything. It's in beef, Monster Munch. for Christ's sake. Yeah. It's got cheese powder in it or something.
Oh my gosh,
so,
yeah.
I mean, so, you know, I'm guessing you're probably okay if you have traces, are you? Because it's an intolerance rather than an allergy.
Yeah. But, you know, if I delved into some whole milk or cream, I get a headache straight away. I feel sick straight away. So it's just not worth it.
Tell us about, well, first of all, congratulations on doing Strictly.
Thank you.
Absolutely amazing. How was it?
Woo! I was a complete non-dancer. I mean, a set of jazz hands was as good as it got before I hit Strictly. And I'm not going to lie, it's probably the most nervous I'd ever been. And I was used to being on stage and performing live, but it's just a different entity because of how many people are watching. And because I didn't have any dance experience, I was literally like Mr. Bean. But I was so lucky.
Weren't. I thought you weren't like Mr. Bean. Come on.
Do you know what? Johannes was the most incredible teacher.
Was he?
And I always say, because the main reason I did Strictly is because I was terrified of it.
Yeah.
I was terrified of it. And I always shied away from dance at drama school. I didn't turn up to the classes. I didn't feel comfortable with it at all. I always felt I looked really different to the other girls who were all tiny little, you know, prima ballerinas. And I was like, oh, I'm too tall. No one will be able to lift me. And Johannes was like, no, baby girl, own this. Oh, I can lift you. You're going to be amazing. Oh, he just empowered me so much.
Did he? Because that was his first time having a partner, wasn't it? You were his first ever partner
God
on the show.
Him. Yeah. So, I put him through his paces, but he was so patient. And by the end of it, I felt like a different person. He'd really given me that confidence that I needed. And yes, it was a challenge, but I just loved it. I loved it.
Obviously, Strictly, probably one of the most stressful things you can actually ever do. Mm-hmm. Very demanding physically, very demanding mentally, takes you away from home. And so how was your IBS when you were doing Strictly?
I was really conscious of it. The self-care was top of my list.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah. So I was doing a lot of cold water therapy, which really helps me. And that's when I have my best meditation is with cold water therapy.
When you say cold water therapy, does this mean, are you swimming outdoors? Are you having a cold shower? Do you have one of these ice baths?
So I was doing a mixture of ice baths and cryotherapy. So going into a cryo chamber two or three times a week when I was doing Strictly because it aided recovery.
Yeah.
And I just... For me, it resets my system.
Wow, okay.
It's the best natural high, but then I get this sense of real inner calm from it. More so from the ice baths because I spend longer in the ice baths. You know, I was kind of doing 5 or 6 minutes in an ice bath after training. And at first, you're really panicky when you get in.
Yeah, you're like, you've got to control
horrendous.
Your breathing.
And I hate being cold.
And then I'm the same. But then it hurts. It actually physically hurts.
I'm not going to lie. First couple of minutes are horrendous. And
okay, is it after the first couple of minutes? Yeah. I don't think I've ever stayed in for longer than that.
Honestly, it's so worth it because suddenly your heart rate just slows down and you just go into this other place. I call it my little cath bubble, and I just kind of like, oh, it's this innate inner calm that I don't feel with anything else. So that's something that I'm really passionate about, and I knew way ahead before the live show started. I was like, I don't want anything kicking off. I don't want to be bloated, especially in the outfits, because you look like you've been dipped in paint. So yeah, it was a lot of self-care. I was eating the right things, making sure I wasn't eating too much fiber as well, which would cause bloating. And a lot of, you know, calming foods and things that help release serotonin. There was a lot of oats involved, which obviously are great for energy as well. So
So you just had to be really, really on it.
Disciplined.
Tell me about, so with your diet, it's this thing with, and we'll get into this a bit later on, a bit more when we have our professional with us, but we know that one of the most important things for your gut health for us as a population is to consume enough fiber. And we should all be aiming for 30 grams of fiber a day, and less than 10% of people actually manage to get that.
Right.
But what we also know is that when people have IBS, when you're having a flare-up of your IBS, then fiber can make it worse. So how have you found the right balance for you? And do you alternate what you eat depending on how you feel?
I've got used to what I can and can't tolerate.
Right.
And over the years, it's funny. I mean, you might be able to explain this more than I can, but sometimes I'll feel like I can't tolerate something, but then I'll try it again a few weeks down the line and I seem to be able to tolerate it more. So I do try and have a lot of cruciferous vegetables, but then hormonally at certain points in my cycle, I can't do that because I just seem to, I don't know, it seems to set my tummy off and I seem to blow even more.
It's so interesting. And I think, you know, in the way that we weren't talking about gut health even just a few years ago, I think the next topic that people are going to talk much more about is hacking our hormones and in terms of our menstrual cycle. Mm-hmm. You know, the conversation now about perimenopause and menopause is much better. People are talking about it, understanding it. But I think we still, and you know, we talk quite a lot about periods, but I think we often don't talk about the other 3 weeks of the cycle and the fluctuations that happen there. And you know, that the thing, like the period poo, often people poo a lot or get diarrhea when they have their period, because like you said, the prostaglandins that help your womb contract can also make your bowel contract, can also make you more sensitive to things like headaches. And actually we have a lower pain threshold. And I wrote a book recently for preteen girls, and I put a whole section of the book was about mastering your hormones, and that you can't change your hormones necessarily. You can if you take the pill, but whilst you can't necessarily change the rhythm of your hormones, you can learn what they're like, and you can adapt your diary and your social plans accordingly. So it's really interesting to say that.
That's amazing that you've done that.
Somebody like yourself with IBS, there are maybe even certain things that you can and can't eat at different times.
I wish I'd had, you know, as a young teenager, I wish I'd had a book like that. I really do, because, you know, it's all well and good. I am very much the kind of woman that goes, I don't care about my cycle. I just plow on. I just carry on working. But the reality is, it can have a huge impact.
Oh, massive.
Like,
massive.
Gosh, when I went to film a new drama last year and I just had my baby, and obviously my hormones were cuckoo. And I was trying a different method of birth control. I was not myself. I look back at that period of time and I go, whoa, that my hormones had affected me, like, hugely. My anxiety was really through the roof. And I've worked out over the years that I'm very progesterone sensitive.
Right.
Which impacts sleep, so causes insomnia. And, you know, I had terrible insomnia with my second pregnancy. It was horrific. But it's things like that that sometimes you only really identify as you get older. One of my good friends is Anise Mukherjee. She's an endocrinologist, and she's been an absolute godsend because these are things that we're not told.
No.
You know, when we first start our periods as young girls, wouldn't have had a Scooby-Doo. If you'd have asked me about progesterone, I'd have been like, what's that? You know,
well, I think, again, it's something that's relatively new to doctors. So I spoke about hacking our hormones at a conference year before last, the British Society of Lifestyle Medicine conference, hundreds of people. But my first slide, actually, was, I was following somebody who'd just given a talk about the gut microbiome, and he must have had about 200 different references for the topics he was talking about. And my first slide was kind of an apology slide that don't have any references, because this is an area where there has been very little to zero scientific research. So therefore, I'm going to ask the audience two questions. First of all, stand up if you're somebody who's ever felt that you're emotions, your skin, your appetite, your diet, your sleep is affected by your monthly cycle. So half the room stood up. And then our second question was, stand up if you know somebody who's monthly, blah, blah, blah. So everyone stood up. So I said, right, there's my evidence that this is an important topic. And I spoke about how our hormones fluctuate through the menstrual cycle, and therefore within each of the four phases, whilst everybody's different, and, you know, people should track their own symptoms alongside their own cycle. But you can expect in that first week when you have your period to have a lower pain threshold, to have period poos, to benefit from eating comfort food. The second week is when your estrogen levels are higher, so you've got a higher pain threshold. You're more likely to get a personal best if you're an athlete, and you benefit from eating certain foods. Third one is when your progesterone is higher. So yeah, you might have poorer sleep, but also you're better at endurance running. And so I researched all this and thought, this is fascinating.
Yeah.
And doctors don't know this. People don't know this. You do, because you're clearly someone who has really invested in your health through knowledge. So I thought, yeah, let's put this in a book for 9 to 13 year olds and let them know it before their periods even start, and be sort of tapping into that knowledge early on.
That's amazing. And I think as well with the nutrition side of things, I remember when I was working with a trainer and I was like, oh no, I'm low carb at the minute. I've got to film this. I had intimate scenes to film and I was like, I'm trying to drop a bit of weight. He was like, nah, you're about to come on your period. You really need your carbohydrates, Kath. Your body's more carb tolerant at this time. All things that I was like, really? Great, chow down. And I feel there's been so many times in my life when I've screwed my body over because of lack of knowledge.
Yeah.
And
well, we think we're doing the right thing because we've been fed all these lies often by the the diet industry. You're right, we've been screwing our bodies over.
I did so many faddy diets growing up. They all screwed my body over. And when I just came back to nature and I got that balance right, I think that's the only way. And of course, as well, to have those treats. Again, I remember saying to my trainer, God, I want some chocolate. He was like, have some high quality dark chocolate.
Yeah.
Because you're going to enjoy it. Your body needs it, you know. And it was just being a bit more reasonable with myself and listening to my body, because I absolutely ignored my body for many years. I just kind of pushed against it, whereas now we're a bit more, we're friends.
It's funny. It's funny. This is something that comes up again and again and again on this podcast, is right. People saying that they really feel that their health progresses and moves forward, not just their health, but also, like you're saying, their relationship with their body, when they get in more in tune with their body, when they start to listen to their body and follow the signals. In fact, there was something you said earlier. We had Emmanuel Sanubi, the comedian, on the podcast, and he was saying how, I was sort of asked him we were talking about heart health, and I said, what's the one message you'll give to people? And he said, treat your body like you treat your car. Said, if you accidentally put the wrong fuel in your car, you panic, you do whatever you needed to do to remove that, and you put the right fuel. We always put the right fuel in our car. And we always look after our car and make sure it looks nice. Like, what we do as human beings, we do the same on the outside. We make sure we look nice, but we put all this horrendous fuel into our bodies.
It's so true.
So true, isn't it?
It's so true. And I look at, you know, I mean, the maternity side of things, you know, once I got pregnant with my first child, I was even more hell-bent on. I was like, I am the soil for an actual human. I mean, it's a lot of pressure. But what I couldn't understand was sometimes the lack of knowledge as well, you know, and many of our midwives are just absolutely wonderful. But I remember feeling really low in energy, and she was like, have a cream cake, have a Mars bar. And I was like, that's not the answer.
No.
But what is the answer? This is what I need to do. I need to make sure I'm getting my good fats, my good carbs, my, you know, and there's still that side of things where you hear about these sugar babies, babies that are being put on sugar drips because mum's diet has been so bad. And that kills me, because it's so preventable if we get it right in schools.
Yeah, you're right. I completely agree. And I think what we really need to focus on is ensuring that, I mean, it's a bigger problem than we can solve here today, but ensuring that families, particularly low-income families, have access to information, but then also have access to good quality food, which is affordable and accessible, and that they're trained, that they know how to cook, they know how to... I was chatting before we actually started this today. I was just chatting to one of our friends in the room, who's going to join us shortly, and saying I once visited a project in Southwark, where I work as a GP, in quite a deprived area of London, and it was a project that was for people who have mental health problems, where they could go and get counselling and meet other people. And they did a survey, and they asked them, how many of your five a day fruit and veg are you managing to get? And over 70% said zero portions of fruit and veg a day. So they started doing some cookery classes and introducing them to fruits and vegetables, and they go out to the market. You know, these markets in London and Manchester where they have, it's a pound a bowl.
Yes.
But they didn't want a whole bowl of carrots. So, you know, they spoke with them, and they could create their own bowl and pick what they wanted, and they brought it back to the project, and they give them a potato peeler, and they'd never seen it before. And this is the issues that we're facing.
I think it's all too easy to say, but the funding isn't there to give so much access to these families. But then you go, you're spending $6 billion a year on obesity. If we make these foods more readily available to these deprived communities, you're going to save yourself. To me, it's a no-brainer. I can't get my head around it. I'm like, come on, guys.
Me too. So before we bring in our expert, what I'd love to ask you is, you're somebody who has cracked it. Yeah. You've gone from a place of, you know, having really awful symptoms that landed you in A&E due to poor diet. You've fixed your diet. You've managed your stress, you've got your ice baths. If somebody's listening and they're thinking, look, I don't feel I can get my life to where Kath's is, you know, that's going to take a long time, could you give them, maybe put you under some pressure, three tips, three things that a typical person could do towards improving their gut health starting from today?
Do you know what? I used to think that it was too long a journey ahead of it. I was like, oh, I can't do that. This is too much. Honestly, I think the three biggest tips for me was reading, educating myself. Secondly, you know, social media is the new world that we live in. There are people like yourself, like Dale Pinnock, the medicinal chef, who are giving sound advice, properly educated advice that is there. If you're going to be scrolling around on your phone, follow the right people and educate yourself. You can educate yourself on these platforms. And, you know, it is baby steps. Keeping a food diary as well, I think, is probably my third, because you'll really surprise yourself. Gosh, this is so, it's so hard to just pick three, because I was going to say a food diary and I'm going to sneak a fourth one
in. Go
on,
sneak a fourth one in.
Eat from the land. Eat as naturally as possible. Yeah. None of the artificial jargon. We all love a treat. I love a bit of cake as much as the next person.
Yeah.
But I think if you're good 90% of the time and you stick to Mother Nature, you can't go far wrong.
Thank you so much. That
Thank
was wonderful.
You.
And we're going to take a short break there. Before we continue with this important conversation, here's a quick message from our sponsor, Bupa. From the mouth to the anus, gut health covers the health of the entire gastrointestinal tract. It's responsible for breaking down our food into individual nutrients that we use to run our bodies. So why does our gut health matter? Well, where to begin? Our gastrointestinal tract contains trillions of microbes. These are a hugely important part of our health. They produce different hormones and vitamins, and we couldn't survive without them. The majority of the cells that make up our immune system are found in our digestive tract too. Having good gut health is linked to fewer sick days and lower risk of allergies and autoimmune conditions. Even if you put the healthiest food into your body, if you don't have a healthy intestinal lining to digest it, you won't get all the benefits of what you're eating. Signs of an unhealthy gut may include an upset stomach, gas, bloating, constipation, unintentional weight changes, sleep disturbances, or constant fatigue, or even skin irritation. If you're experiencing symptoms of poor gut health, Bupa members have access to Bupa Bluer Health, a digital GP service that offers expert, confidential medical advice right when you need it, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can talk to a doctor, nurse, or pharmacist about your symptoms. Although Bupa doesn't cover you for conditions you already have before taking out the policy, you can still use the Bupa Bluer Health app to speak to a medical professional about any medical concern you have. So I'm really delighted that we're now joined by Niamh Hennessy, who is Head of Dietetics at the Cromwell Hospital. Niamh, first of all, tell us about your experience and what it is that you do at the Cromwell.
So thank you for having me. I'm Head of Dietetics at the Cromwell Hospital. So I manage the department. We have three adult dietitians and a paediatric specialist dietitian and a dietetic assistant with us in the team. And I started practicing dietetics back in 2009. I suppose I started like most dietitians. I had inpatients and an outpatient clinic, and I would regularly see patients with IBS in our general outpatient clinics.
Great. And how common is IBS now? I think I said about one in five. Is that accurate?
I'd say it's very fairly accurate. We get quite large numbers through every week looking to book in with the dietitians at the Cromwell Hospital. We find that it's a bit difficult to get access to dietetic help in the public sector at the mm-hmm. moment, that mm-hmm. the numbers are so high. Yeah. But we found quite interesting a lot more female patients coming to see us than male. Now, we still get quite a few male adults come as well, but we're seeing an awful lot more women coming to see us for help.
And you've been listening to the conversation that Kath and I just had. So what were your initial thoughts, and was there anything that you wanted to sort of just add to or pick up on?
Yeah, no, it was really interesting listening to all the changes you've made, and it resonates quite a lot with the stories that we hear in clinic on a regular basis. So it's great that you've managed to make all those changes, and it was really nice hearing about the food and symptoms diary, because we use that quite a lot in practice, and we often suggest to people before they come to clinic to keep it for themselves so mm-hmm. they can get the most out of their time with us in clinic, because I think you truly get to know yourself and how you react to either your lifestyle but predominantly the food that you're eating. And it means then when you're giving advice in clinic, it's so much more beneficial to the individual.
Yeah, everyone's so completely different, aren't they? And, you know, hearing hearing Kath's story there is really inspiring. Was there anything you wanted to pick on in particular that you think is sort of something that's quite unique to Kath or something that's quite general that other people could have a go at?
Thinking back to how you broke up your day, I thought that all sounded really, really good. Your breakfast was particularly a good breakfast, and the changes especially you've made. Quite often for people who are busy or rushing around, we find oats actually quite beneficial in the morning, because often there's so many really nice recipes now for the overnight oats, and they're becoming really popular. I know some of the dietitians, we're always looking at how we can modify recipes in the department, and we have a really good one for an oat muffin, and it has all your good ingredients for your microbiome that I'm sure you're going to have a chat about later. And it's just, people can pick it up quick and easy, it can be cooked in advance, and it's those kind of things that really help people stick to the changes. The other thing I probably would mention is around hydration, and that's another point that's really, really key when you're looking at most people's diets, but particularly if you've got IBS, because it can have a big impact on your gut, and it's one that we pay particular focus to, and you really need to tailor it to the individual. So I suppose you use 8 pints, but everyone's lifestyle is different, so we normally work off about 2 to 2.5 litres, so that would be about 3-4 pints of water a day, but you don't have to have it all from water. Water, it can be any drinks, really.
Except alcoholic drinks.
You're dead right.
Because I think sometimes people say, well, what about tea and coffee? Because they contain caffeine, and caffeine's a diuretic and it makes you pee. But they do count towards your volume of fluid intake, don't they?
Yeah, no, they do. And we actually worked through that quite a few years ago, where there was some research was done into the importance of fluid and hydration, and they do include it in it now.
Better to have maybe 4 glasses of water and 4 cups of tea than just 4 glasses of water, because the tea counts too.
Tea counts too. And I think it all depends at your stage in your life. You know, for obviously younger people, it's really important they have that variety.
Yeah.
So they're having enough water. But if you've got an older person and all they'll drink is cups of tea, it's better for them to have the cups of tea. But I think when we're looking at today, it's general health and well-being, and it's our general population. We want that mix in there. So that's why we kind of have that golden rule of about 2 litres of water a day, because then you'll get the other through your teas and your coffees.
And what's the best way for an individual person to assess their own hydration level, to know if they should be drinking more or not?
So we find it quite useful in clinic, and I know speaking to lots of different people that you use your urine as a good example. So if it's very dark in colour, then you're more likely to be dehydrated, and you're looking for your champagne or your straw-like colour is when you're properly hydrated, because you want to be in the middle. We don't want extremes, because if you're too overhydrated, that's not good for you either.
Was there anything else in our conversation that sort of struck you as really interesting, or anything that you just thought, oh, I wish I was chatting with them now so I could just add this?
So I thought what was great was around when you spoke about going back to nature, and when you spoke about having the unprocessed foods, because that's something that we really do encourage in clinic, and it's something we find can make a big difference to symptom control. So when we're looking at trying to avoid the heavily processed foods, and you quite rightly said there are times when you can't avoid it, but if you're doing it the 90% of the time, you actually do feel much better as a result. And I know you mentioned at the beginning about restricting what you're eating to try and identify what foods suit you better than other foods. And I think that's really important. And it's something that we find people are really great at doing the restriction side of things. But sometimes when they're getting such good relief from symptoms, they forget about the reintroducing of some of the foods that are associated with, you know, your symptoms of your bloating, or that they may feel cause them some of, you know, either diarrhea or constipation, one of the main symptoms we have of IBS. But we need to look at our body as a whole, and it's important you get a good variety and diversity in your diet. So we don't want people becoming malnourished in one way so that they've got less diversity in their diet, because we'll speak about later, from a microbiome point of view, the more diversity we have in our diet, the better it is for us, for health and well-being.
Yeah. So we will come on. We'll definitely talk about the microbiome and the gut-brain axis because it's just fascinating. And I think when people get their head around that, a lot of stuff starts to make sense. But yes, so we're referring a little bit there to FODMAPs and exclusion diets. And Kath, when you started playing around with different foods, did you have support with that? Did you have a nutritionist or a dietitian or a doctor?
Yeah, again, I'm really lucky because I'd become really good friends with Dale Pinnock, who is very much up on you know, FODMAPs and that side of things. It's something he deals with a lot. So he was just advising me, you know, again, the food diary thing really came into play, and it's really quick to do. I just carried my phone everywhere with me and would just mark down what I'd eaten. And like I say, there were certain foods that, you know, sometimes I felt a bit sensitive to, but then a few weeks down the line, I'd eat them and I was absolutely fine. Mm. So I think that's important. Like you say, you don't want to exclude food groups unnecessarily. If your body is going through, you know, either something hormonally or your cortisol levels are high, then, you know, that can make the food seem like it's affecting you in a different way when actually you might be okay with it. So that was probably the most helpful thing for me. And I've got to say, I'm fine with most things now. I feel like I'm able to have a really varied diet. And there's not much that I don't like. I pretty much eat everything.
So it sounds like for you, it was excluding the crap, wasn't it?
Completely.
Just the processed food, the fast food, the junk food.
Yeah, just
the
taking
Haribo?
It. No, I don't touch it.
No, you're not
bothered. If I want something sweet, you know, something that I'm really passionate about as well is, you know, taking desserts, puddings, things that we love, the comfort foods, and putting a healthy spin on them. Yeah. Because, you know, using natural sugars, for example, you know, things like honey and coconut sugar, maple syrup, things like that, small changes mean you can still have a sweet treat. And my husband has the biggest sweet tooth. And I do this chocolate cake. It's completely with natural ingredients, natural sugars, almond flour. He couldn't tell the difference. He ate the whole thing. And I was like, let me tell you about the benefits of that cake. And he's like, oh my gosh. You know, and we don't always have the time to do that. But as and when I can, you know, if we're having a sweet treat and I've got the time, I think, well, I might as well use stuff that's going to benefit us.
Yeah, my other half, he makes this. I'm not much of a dessert person. I love sweet stuff, but it's never been part of my routine to have a dessert.
Yeah.
But he always wants to have a pudding after dinner.
That's like Tom.
So it's not good for me because if he's having it, I want it. But he makes this lovely, he just gets raspberries, he just mashes them up with some proper full-fat Greek yogurt and a tiny little bit of honey. And that's what
gorgeous.
We... And I just have a small little portion of that and it's so delicious and it's full of goodness. So it sounds like, you know, you can eat apart from the dairy, just about everything if it's healthy. But I think one of the dilemmas I often have, Niamh, as a GP, is I see lots of people who are having issues with IBS and we can get onto some of the other ways of managing it other than what we eat. But often what they'll come in, they'll say, you know, these are my symptoms, these are the things we've tried. And I know really for the next step for that patient is a FODMAP or an exclusion diet. Mm-hmm. And the line we're supposed to give is that you shouldn't attempt this on your own, because the issue is often people eliminate things, feel better, then don't reintroduce things. So they end up, you know, lacking in nutrition, essentially. So the line I know I'm meant to give is that, you know, we'll refer you for some dietetic support and wait until then. But with waiting lists being 6 months plus, it's not really realistic to ask people to do that. And there'll be people listening to this, I'm sure, as well, who are thinking, well, this is me. I think I have IBS. I didn't know about FODMAP exclusion. They're going to go online. They're going to research it. They're going to try it. So what's the best approach if somebody can't afford to go private, can't access NHS dietetic support for some time and they want to have a go at this?
I think it's accessing, as you said earlier, a reputable source and getting the advice from somewhere that you can trust. Mm-hmm. And I know we've got some great influencers online and there's lots of advice available out there, but not all of it is as accurate and factually correct as what we would like it to be. So we're very lucky here in the UK. We've the British Dietetic Association and they have a lot of resources. They're available free for anyone to pick up and to go with. And what I would do is go for your first line advice and try that first. For a large proportion of people, that will work. And it's all the things that you've spoken about today. It's avoiding our processed foods. It's making sure that we're eating regularly and we've got good posture when we're eating, making sure we're not eating very late at night. It's avoiding fizzy drinks. It's avoiding lots of alcohol because that can aggravate the gut. It's being mindful and not having excessive amounts of caffeine containing drinks because they can also too be a bit of an aggravator. And it's some of the key things like onions and garlic. And it's not, like you said, avoiding them forever. It's doing it for, and I think this is the key thing, if you're going to try it, it's 4 to 8 weeks, no longer than that.
Right.
And that's from a safety perspective, so you don't become malnourished or end up with micronutrient deficiencies.
And would you have a resource that we could add to the show notes, which is this first line advice for IBS that people can access?
Yep, I can give you access to it. And the British Dietetic Association, they have a first line advice that I share when Brilliant. We do talks with our GPs.
And then a friend of mine, Rhiannon Lambert, she does some really great stuff as well as Dale Pinnock. They're great as well. So maybe, I think it's tricky when if you're looking for somebody to follow on social media, there are some pitfalls, aren't there? You know, a blue tick doesn't necessarily mean that person is qualified. You know, I've got a blue tick, but I'm not qualified to give you this sort of advice about dietetics. So just have a look at what qualifications somebody has. If somebody is a registered dietitian, if somebody is a registered nutritionist, then those really probably you're looking for people to have those qualifications to be given this sort of advice around FODMAPs, or perhaps if somebody's a doctor and they're a gastroenterologist who specializes in this type of thing. Otherwise, you know, even if somebody looks great, you know, they look super healthy, you know, somebody like Kathy looks fantastic and she's been on the journey, you know, listening to her story and her experiences is really, really interesting, but
Not qualified
to give us the advice.
You're completely right. I think it's part of the problem as well. We you know, we have a lot of influencers that look amazing and some of them are advertising horrendous diets.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's something else that I'm really passionate about. I'm like, I'm sure you're making a load of money off that, but is it responsible? And what are we doing to our younger generations by promoting extreme diets or faddy diets? I think you're completely right. And Rhiannon is brilliant. I follow Rhiannon. Yeah, she's great. She's helped me a lot in the past as well.
And she does simple, I think she does simple things, doesn't she, that we can all take on board. She doesn't overcomplicate it.
Totally.
She's not trying to get you to be perfect. It's like just about making those incremental changes towards being a little bit healthier.
Yeah, you're right. And I love it when she goes to the supermarket as well, because like as a busy mum, you just want our biggest constraints often in society are time and budget, and she's great at going, oh, this is on sale now and this is great and that's better and da da da, and you're like, okay, great, job done.
Okay, so the final bit we're going to talk about today is we're going to get into a little bit of this science, which is relatively new, all about gut health and gut microbiomes and gut brain axis. And I think there are all these terms that are quite familiar to people now, but I did an event recently with Bupa, actually a live event, and one of the presenters asked the question to the audience, who's heard of the gut microbiome, and most hands went up. But when she said, who would be able to tell me what the gut microbiome is, only about 5 hands went up. So I think we're at that point where people are aware of the terms and it's all a bit interesting, but it's still a bit confusing. So I think, Niamh, first of all, what is the gut microbiome?
So I suppose the gut microbiome is microorganisms in our gut, and it's made up of trillions of bacteria, but also viruses. Lots of them are beneficial to health, but there are some that are toxic to our gut health as well. We're looking at trying to intensify the good bacteria in our gut so that they have beneficial impact on our gut health and well-being, and try and make sure that we have enough good bacteria in our gut as opposed to our toxic bacteria that can have negative effects on our health and well-being. And we use our microbiome as part of our digestive process, especially with our insoluble fiber that we eat in our diet. And that's how I would explain it in clinic. Now, I know from a medical point of view, you might go into more detail.
There's a couple of things I always remember that I just think they're so interesting, that there are as many cells in our gut microbiome, so as many individual microbes as there are cells of our own bodies. And that if you were to take it all into one space, it would weigh as much as quite a hefty lump. And, you know, if we look after them, they look after us. And you want it to be as diverse as possible as well, don't you? You want to have a very wide, diverse, different number of microorganisms. And one way we can ensure that is to make sure we're not only in lots of fruit and vegetables and nuts and seeds and whole grains, but having a wide variety, ideally aiming for 30 plant points a week, which sounds like a lot, but there are some tips and tricks and ways in which you can get towards that quite easily. I put this little recipe on my Instagram where what I do now, I love oats in the morning as well. So I get one of those big jars and I put some oats in. I put some flaxseed in. I put cinnamon and mixed spice. I put some dried cranberries, some dried raisins, sultanas, whatever dried fruit, a bit of desiccated coconut. And I build it up and build it up and stir it all up. And then I keep it in the fridge and either make it porridge or overnight oats with it. And I managed to get up to 17 plant points.
Wow.
At one point. So I thought, if I have that just once a week, I'm over halfway there. So there are ways of making it more achievable. It's just about trying to think about ways of increasing diversity.
That's why I love a smoothie as well. Smoothie, I just throw everything in a smoothie.
Whatever you've got, if you've got some, a little bit of, if you've got some mint as well, or, you know, whatever you've got going, sprinkle a few dried seeds in there, few
spinach, carrots.
Yeah, any leftover
anything
veg, which
is great for the kids as well, actually, because as long as I'm, you know, balancing out with berries or strawberries or a banana or whatever, that 9 times out of 10, they don't know that there's veg and seeds.
Well, so what other tips do either of you have for how we can, with families, with busy lives, go about trying to increase the diversity of plant fibres? I mean, smoothies are a great one.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, really. It's getting it into every meal that we eat. So I think it's having a couple in your breakfast. So bananas are often a really good option. You've got your oats, looking at different fruits. Normally you can get at least one or two in with your breakfast in the morning. Obviously, being mindful for the general population, we normally go for one in the morning, just when you're looking at the sugar content. And these are all natural sugars, which are good for you. And then at lunchtime, you can normally get in two types of vegetables, maybe salad if you're deciding to have a sandwich, or a sourdough bread is really popular at the moment, which is really good for gut health as well. Looking at having carrot sticks with hummus is another really good snack for people. And then in the evening, it's getting as many different types of vegetables, nuts and pulses into your evening meal. And as you've said with what you were talking about there, most people who say, oh, I don't eat this or I don't eat that, especially if they come over and say, oh, I don't eat vegetables, I was smiling because I'm like, there was about 4 or 5 different veg in that lasagna you ate. And, you know, you turned around to me and say, I don't eat vegetables. And I was like, well, there's carrots and mushrooms and onions and, you know, courgettes. You can get so many different veg into your main meal in the evening that it shouldn't be difficult or a chore. And I think that's what we need to get across to people, is having a healthy, balanced diet should be something you enjoy and look forward to. Salads are great with lots of different meals so that you can get that more vegetables in.
And what about probiotics? What's your standpoint on those?
As you've said earlier, the research is more and more coming on board all of the time. And I know a lot of people have found really great benefits, especially with bloating. And I know there's new products coming on the market all of the time. What I would say is you need to go with what works for you. So it's worth trying it, but go to a reputable source, because buying stuff off the internet, you don't always know what you're getting. And a lot of the time, because it's a supplement, it doesn't have to go through the same stringent regulations as other products.
There are guidelines now for prescribing probiotics for traveler's diarrhea, or for a type of diarrhea called C. diff, which sometimes people get if they've had lots and lots of antibiotics. Do you think in the future we'll see prescriptions for probiotics being used for other purposes?
I think we will do, and especially when it's antibiotic related.
That's brilliant, because antibiotics, I had to do some recently and they are brutal.
Well, that's the thing about antibiotics. You know, if you need antibiotics, you know, they might save your life. Absolutely have them. But if we take antibiotics unnecessarily, they're wiping out all of our good bacteria as well. But of course, there are natural probiotics as well. Fermented foods, so yogurt, certain types of cheeses, kimchi, sauerkraut, kefir, all these things. If actually try it, and if you like it and can just add it to your weekly shop, then that's a good thing to do as well. Final thing, I know we're out of time, but can you just explain a little bit about this gut-brain axis that everybody's raving about, how our brain and our gut are physically connected to each other? There's a nerve called the vagus nerve that actually physically connects the two, and also chemicals. So the gut microbiome produces lots of hormones and other chemicals that communicate with the brain, and then in turn chemicals from the brain communicate with the gut. So they are constantly communicating with each other. So, you know, if your gut is happy and healthy, it can actually positively impact mental well-being. And if you're stressed or you're suffering from an emotional point of view, well, that can impact on how well your gut's functioning. And I guess we can think of examples of that. You know, when you're nervous, say if you've got to give a speech or something, we get gut symptoms, don't we? We get butterflies, or, you know, sometimes people get diarrhea. And equally, you know, when your gut is not functioning well, often people do link that to how they're feeling.
So our gut-brain axis, we see it quite a lot in clinical practice. And you'll see, as you mentioned, that quite often your symptoms will be when you're more stressed, that you'll find you get more severe symptoms. And we've noticed from doing the food diaries quite a lot, stress and anxiety is very closely linked with the symptoms of IBS. And it's there's lots of research, as you know, going on in that area at the moment, and it is strongly linked. So what we find is, if we can get people to do either mindfulness, so your likes of your meditation, physical activity, gentle forms of physical activity regular during the week, you can have a real big impact on your gut health and well-being. And it's just having that time to yourself to reduce the stress levels. We're all busy with our personal lives, but also with our working lives, and we put a lot of pressure on ourselves. So it's really, really important that we find that time to reduce that stress and anxiety, to support, particularly with the gut-brain axis.
And it might not be an ice bath for everybody, but
no.
Do you know what? Sometimes
that's what works for you.
If I'm early for the school pickup, or I'm early for an appointment, 5-10 minutes early, I recline the chair back in my car and I just put a meditation on, and just do some breathing. Because like you say, we're all super busy. Just finding that 5 minutes really helps to
You mentioned cortisol, and that's what it's about. It's the way they think that ice baths work as well, isn't it? As well as that, it's about calming down your sympathetic nervous system. So your sympathetic nervous system, when that's all revved up, fight, flight, freeze when you face a bear in the wild. But actually, for good digestion and to alleviate stress, we need to be in our parasympathetic, which is our rest and digest. No bears. If there's no bear, you don't need to be your sympathetic. But we spend a lot of our lives these days with busy lives, with electronics, with, you know, we spend a lot of our time with that sympathetic nervous system switched on when it doesn't need to be. And that is so closely linked to our gut health and how our digestion works and how we feel. Well, thank you both so much for joining me. That was such an interesting episode, and I'm sure many people listening to this will be taking away a lot of tips and tricks and advice and education, which is so important. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That final reminder to people listening that if you are having symptoms related to your gut and you haven't yet had a diagnosis of IBS, it's really important to see your GP, because there are all those other conditions that can cause similar symptoms. And thank you for joining me, Dr. Zoe Williams, on The Doctor Will Hear You Now. For future episodes, to make sure that you're the first to know of their release, click follow wherever you're listening right now. Also, tell us if you liked it. Leave a rating or review, or share with a friend. You can find me on Instagram at Dr. Zoe Williams, and I look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Insanity Group.
Thank you to our fantastic series sponsor, Bupa. Here's a quick message from them. From the mouth to the anus, gut health covers the health of the entire gastrointestinal tract. It's responsible for breaking down our food into individual nutrients that we use to run our bodies. So why does our gut health matter? Well,
where to begin? Our gastrointestinal tract contains trillions of microbes. These are a hugely important part of our health. They produce different hormones and vitamins, and we couldn't survive without them. The majority of the cells that make up our immune system are found in our digestive tract too. Having good gut health is linked to fewer sick days and lower risk of allergies and autoimmune conditions. Even if you put the healthiest food into your body, if you don't have a healthy intestinal lining to digest it, you won't get all the benefits of what you're eating. Signs of an unhealthy gut may include an upset stomach, gas, bloating, constipation, unintentional weight changes, sleep disturbances, or constant fatigue, or even skin irritation. If you're experiencing symptoms of poor gut health, Bupa members have access to Bupa Bluer Health, a digital GP service that offers expert, confidential medical advice right when you need it, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can talk to a doctor, nurse, or pharmacist about your symptoms. Although Bupa doesn't cover you for conditions you already have before taking out the policy, you can still use the Bupa Bluer Health app to speak to a medical professional about any medical concern you have.